All right. We'll call the Civil Law Committee to order. Members, welcome to the 2011 session. And first, I'll get into some introductions, but let me just offer a few comments first. And on the Civil Law Committee, we anticipate some rules that I'll get a draft out in the near future, but we don't have them yet. A couple things to note. I will likely require a 24-hour amendment rule ahead of time to have amendments. And also to the audience, I will be somebody that will ask for the information or handouts ahead of time as well, and we would ask for them electronically as well as paper copies. You can talk to John or myself at a later date, but just a couple highlights that we will have in the rules when we bring them forward. Let's first introduce staff to everybody. John Reynolds, to my right, is our new committee assistant for the Civil Law Committee. And to my left is Sarah Novinsky. She will be the CLA and the person to talk to if you are late or need to miss a committee or have questions. John, otherwise as well, use them as much as you need to. To his left, or to Sarah's left, my left, is Matt Gehring, our familiar House Research researcher that's staffs the Civil Law Committee, and Lynn Aves will be handling some of the family law matters, so she'll be here a little later. Lynn is to Matt's left. Okay. So they'll be our House Research contacts. I'm going to let our committee pages introduce themselves briefly, and then members, I'll ask you to go around and introduce yourself. We've got some new members on the committee, as well as new members to the legislature who are also on the committee. And give just a brief background where you're from and what would be helpful for us to know, and then we'll get into the committee agenda. The pages, could you introduce yourselves?
My name is Colin Furness, and this is my second year, and I live in St. Paul.
Okay, Colin.
I'm Kaylee, and this is my first year as a page, and I'm from Morris, but currently live in St. Paul.
Very good. They will be our pages for the committees, so members, if you need something, get their attention, and they'll be happy to help out. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think one staffer still needs to be introduced, Emily Ness. Oh,
you're right. Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Emily, you want to introduce yourself?
Emily Nessie, and I'm GOP House Research.
And DFL, I think, has a research, too.
Kate Weeks, DFL Caucus Research.
DFL, okay. Is there anybody else staff that I forgot? And then let's start on the end of the left side of the table. If you want to just come around and introduce yourself, members, for the audience and the rest of the committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Tim Mahoney, and I represent District 67A. Nice to be here.
Mr. Chair, I'm Representative John Lash. I represent District 66A in my fifth term, and I am the designated DFL lead for the committee. Thank you for hosting this committee today.
You're welcome. And for anybody that doesn't have all the districts memorized, St. Paul, I think, is what you both represent, right?
That's right, Mr. Chair.
Deborah Hillstrom, I represent District 46B, which is all of the City of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park, and I am in my sixth term in the House.
And a new lawyer. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Hortman, and I represent part of Brooklyn Park and part of Coon Rapids, and this is the beginning of my fourth term.
Mr. Chair, Steve Simon, District 44A, which is St. Louis Park and Hopkins, and I'm in my fourth term.
I'm Bill Hilty. I represent District 8A, which is parts of Pine, Carlton, and St. Louis counties, and I'm beginning my eighth term. As I note, Mr. Chair, so are you.
classmates.
Representative Sandra Peterson, I represent Plymouth New Hope Crystal, District 45A, and this is the beginning of my fourth term.
And Tori Westrom, chair of the committee, I represent District 11A up by Alexandria from Elba Lake, Western Minnesota.
Steve Driskowski, 28B, Southern Goodhue and Wabasha Counties and Northern Winona County.
Glenn Grunhagen, I'm a freshman. I represent District 25A, which is Eastern Sibley and Le Sueur County.
Mr. Chair, I'm Peggy Scott, and I represent Andover and Ham Lake, which is District 49A.
Representative Joyce Pepin, I represent House District 32A, which is Corcoran, Dayton, Greenfield, Hanover, Hassan, Rogers, and Maple Grove, and I'm in my fourth term.
Mr. Chair, Linda Runback from District 53A, which is Circle Pines, Lionel Lakes, North Oaks, Shoreview, a little bit of Blaine, and I'm in my third term in the House, but I did spend two terms in the Senate. In the 90s.
Well, welcome, welcome back. We're glad to see the promotion.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair, Joe Hoppe from Chaska, my fifth term classmate of Representative Lesher's and new to the Civil Law Committee.
Mr. Chair, Mary Liz Holberg, 36A, which is most of Lakeville, my seventh term and my seventh term on Civil Law Committee.
Very good. Thank you for that. I will note, I think we've got two other members that had a conflict. Doug Wardlow and Pat Mazerol. So we'll let them introduce themselves later if they make it or at our next committee. Speaking of our next committee members, looking at our schedule, it appears that we won't meet until next Wednesday, a week from this Wednesday, because Wednesday we're off, and to the audience, we're off for the symposium on Wednesday. All committees have been canceled for the annual legislative symposium over at the U, I believe it is. And next Monday, if I got my dates right, is Martin Luther King Day, and we're off for that as well. So it appears next Wednesday will be our next committee meeting. Just we'll send out notices, but just a FYI. One other logistical issue, members of the committee, if you have questions, raise your hand. John, our CA, will keep a list of people with questions. He's also going to serve as my eyes, and so he'll be the one you want to get attention. If I don't look at your hand raised, don't take offense. So. With that, let's start on our agenda. What we want to go through is just get our feet wet and get the creative juices flowing and get ready to review bills in the weeks ahead. But a couple things we thought we would review is hear from the Bar Association, and also hear about some family law issues and just recap to kind of update our committee and get thinking about where we've been and what changes might be coming ahead. I'll first call Mr. Brian Lake from the MSBA. We've asked him to just offer us a little insight into what the Bar Association might be thinking for 2011 changes that might be coming ahead, and to introduce himself to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Lake, welcome to the committee. If you can identify yourself for the record, you can proceed.
Brian Lake. I'm with the State Bar Association. I've worked with many of you. Looking forward to working with other members of this committee. The bar has a long history of collaborating with this committee, and it's various forms through the years. And for those of you who don't know, the Bar Association represents over 16,000 attorneys in Minnesota. And within the bar, there are over 30 different sections that are focused on specific areas of the law. A handful of those sections have historically worked with this committee, and those include the family law section, business law, real property, and probate. And we have typically worked with the committee in a few different ways. The first is, you may see over the course of the biennium, some bills that come from the Bar Association. These typically come up from the various sections that I just mentioned. And when you see those bills, you can rest assured that they have gone through a very careful and thorough vetting process. They are typically nonpartisan, very technical bills, dealing with perhaps clearing up some ambiguities in areas of law or updating laws to match current practices. But in general, like I said, very technical, nonpartisan legislation. The bar will also occasionally comment on other organizations' bills, again, generally from a technical perspective, making sure that there are no perhaps unforeseen or unintended consequences from the way the language is drafted, and just in general trying to make sure that that the laws as written will be applied as intended. So really just kind of being a technical resource. And on that note, I do want to mention as well that the bar is always happy to work with any member at any time on any issue. I know you're going to hear later from House Research staff. Those of you who are new and haven't had the privilege of working with them, you will soon learn that they are just an invaluable resource here for everyone. They really do fantastic work. If there's anything that they can't answer, we are always happy to assist members of the committee with technical questions about various bills that you might be working on, how they might get applied in the real world, or various assistance with making sure that what you intend is going to actually be the result. So you may see this session perhaps probably by next year for sure. So various proposals coming through from the bar, and like I said, we'll probably be working on several proposals that are going to come through this committee this year. And like I mentioned, I was really privileged to work with some current members of the committee in the past, and looking forward to working with the rest of you this year. And Mr. Chair, again, I thank you for the opportunity to come talk to the committee today.
Any questions for Mr. Lake? Mr. Lake, we look forward to working through several bills, and if some of your committees have some, the sooner we could get those bill drafts, the better. But I know oftentimes they have provisions, as you spoke about, and so that goes for all members and everybody in the audience. If you've got bills and ideas or changes you're thinking of, the sooner we could get them in, the sooner we'd like to get started on hearing bills. And the better chance of getting bills heard, just because we know how the crunch comes during committee deadline, and not everything can be heard when it gets close to committee deadline. So the sooner you have them, the better off we are. So thank you, Mr. Lake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we're going to ask Mr. Waylon Campbell to give us a little history on child support and child custody issues or family law issues. He's from the Division of Child Support at the Department of Human Services. And so, Mr. Campbell, if you can identify yourself for the record. And members, if you've got a urgent question in the middle, let us know. Otherwise, if you can jot it down, and it works to ask it at the end, feel free. We'll open it up for questions. But I've asked if the department could give us just 20-30 minutes of review of some of the major changes in family law areas of the last 10 years to get us kind of up to speed on that. But recognizing, I know some members, Representative Mahoney, I know you've had an interest in family law issues, and I anticipate there will be some bills that come forward to this committee, and so I thought it's a good backdrop to get us thinking about where we've been, where what changes have been made, and what changes are kind of lingering out there that might be discussed. And so, Mr. Campbell, welcome to our committee, and if you can identify yourself for the record, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Waylon Campbell. I'm the director of the Child Support Enforcement Division in the Department of Human Services. I've gone through what we can find in the time we had allowed, the laws of approximately the last 10 years, and I thought I would spend some time on those. I thought I would start, however, by giving just a very brief orientation to what the child support program is, how it works and stuff, a very short. And then actually I would invite questions as you have them, because you might forget them as we go along. So anyway, the child support program is essentially a federal program. It's highly prescriptive in terms of what it requires all states to do. It does this, I believe, because it is operated in all states, and all states operate cases for each other. So we have cases from the other 49 states, and the other 49 states have Minnesota cases that they operate. And so to maintain a kind of an integrity of the system, the federal government has provided more oversight, I think, in the child support program than it has in other programs where it's allowed more leeway in terms of what states will do. In Minnesota, the child support program is administered by the Child Support Enforcement Division in the Department of Human Services. It's actually, well, it's supervised there. It's administered primarily out in the counties, in local child support agencies in the Department of Human Services in those counties, with the exception of Ramsey County, where the child support office is located within the Attorney General's office. The program is heavily...
Mr. Campbell, I think somebody might have their cell phone on. If people could shut their cell phones off. I think that's the giving us the feedback in the microphones. If everybody could check cell phones. Go ahead.
I apologize if that was my cell phone.
You've got about 13 or 14 other people.
Joe took the battery out of his.
Joe was always a kind of definite kind of guy.
I aim to please, Mr. Chair.
The program is federally funded at a 66% rate. That means that for every dollar on it, an administration that either the state or the county performs on child support activities, the federal government provides 66% of that cost. It also provides incentives to states based on their performance on five performance measures and on their total collections base. So that's in addition to that money. Until very recently, states used to be able to earn federal participation by spending those incentives, which in Minnesota is about $12 million we get every year. And when we spent that million, we could earn more federal money, and that was discontinued as of the end of the last federal fiscal year. And that's a significant decrease in the amount of revenue that we're going to have available for the program. It's to the tune of about $24 million a year. I thought I would start back. I went as far back as about 1999 in terms of looking at what is happening with the child support program in Minnesota. And there's been several big events since that time. In 1999, there was the Holmberg decision, which determined that the Supreme Court decision, in which they determined that the our administrative process that we used to establish child support orders at the time was unconstitutional, and it required us to implement an expedited process, and we did that. Another big theme in the Minnesota child support program occurred in 2005 with the passage of the child support guidelines. And I'll say more about that as we go through. There's only one big piece of federal legislation that has occurred over the last 10 or so years that I'm aware of, and that's the Deficit Reduction Act, and that's had effect on certainly on our on the income that the program is able to get. It has an effect on how we distribute support. On the assignment of support that people make when they apply for public assistance, et cetera. Essentially, the Holmberg but going back now to 1999, the Holmberg decision basically found that Minnesota violated the Constitution in two areas, the Minnesota Child Support Program, in that there was a violation of the separation of powers issues, and there was also unauthorized practice of law where child support workers and not attorneys were doing things that only attorneys should do. And so they put together a process that resulted in the expedited process, which was implemented, I think, almost within a year of that decision. And that's what we've had ever since. And the expedited process is primarily a judicial process that we had before we had the administrative process. In the year 2000, a number of things occurred. We implemented the financial institution data match. This is an enforcement program where we can match on assets in accounts and take them after certain due process considerations are gone through. The legislature authorized the pass-through of collected child support on public assistance cases, but it did so without a disregard. So the child support, although it's passed through to the parent receiving assistance, the money is budgeted against the grant. The state passed an ex parte order for child support to disclose address information to one party if it is needed to serve the other party. We have very tight data privacy concerns. We can't just give the address of one person to another person, even though they used to be married. But this allows, in the case of when one needs to serve the other party, that the other party can get an ex parte order to do so. There was also an enforcement a legislation passed regarding the enforcement of the custodial parent's obligation to pay medical support, and it was done in such a way as to offset the support paid by the other parent. So, if let's say the parent without the children is the father, and the father has to pay support and has health insurance for the child, but the mother of that child needs to reimburse for the health insurance, it's done through an offset. So we'll subtract the health insurance, custodial parent's health insurance proportion of the premium from the child support. That's the way that was set up.
Mr. Campbell, question on the reimbursement issues. Do all child support payments go through the county intermediary, or do a lot of them go directly back and forth between the divorced spouses?
The child support payments go through the child support payment center, which we operate at the state level. They used to go through the counties, so no child support payments are supposed to go through the counties at the present time. However, not everybody is required to be part of the program. People can opt out of the program, and if they do so, then they would presumably be paying themselves directly. Okay. In 2001, language was passed to neutralize the words custodial parent, non-custodial parent, and they changed the non-custodial parent language to be the parent with whom the child does not reside. Also, in 2001, we adopted child support as can be a felony, so we've introduced criminal non-support to the previous civil contempt that we could get. So, in 2002, with respect to driver's license suspension, laws were passed to allow for a 90-day temporary driver's license to allow a person to get to work and to petition the court for a modification of the support obligation. Also, the law provided for a graduated payment of payment agreement for based on the obligor's ability to pay. As a result of probably not payment and having a threat of having the license taken away. In 2003, we passed
Mr. Campbell, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Campbell, I'm just wondering, in light of current economic conditions, if your agency has been making
if your caseworkers and so forth are trying to accommodate some of these non-custodial parents, for lack of, I don't remember your former term that you just introduced there, but are some adjustments being made so these non-custodial parents don't get so behind if they don't have a job or have taken a significant pay cut?
Yes, Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the non-custodial parent, or, and I apologize for using that word, I don't mean it in any derogatory sense whatsoever, even though they changed the law, because it's too mind-boggling to use all those words. But if that individual, we encourage all the counties to work with individuals to stay connected with both the custodial and non-custodial parents to keep on track of what their economic situation is. We do not want people to be ordered to pay a given amount of child support if they can't afford it. And so we would encourage that person to come in and get a modification of that amount, because the idea is not to collect as much money as we can collect. The idea is to collect the amount of money that's appropriate for the circumstances. Does that answer your question, Representative Scott?
Representative Scott. Thank you.
Representative Mahoney.
I'm not positive how to phrase this question, but I'll make an attempt. In light of the last question and answer, I think it would be more appropriate to ask, how many modifications do you see in a month or in a year, given the cost of going to court, even with an ex parte filing? My understanding is that it's relatively rare to get a change and relatively expensive. So do you know how many you typically see at the state level, the orders from the courts?
Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I don't have a number for you today, but we can find out and do some research and try to find out and report that information to the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Representative Mahoney.
Just so long, because typically what happens is we get a raw number, and that doesn't really do much good. So the number should probably be percentage of those who file and those that get. So if you have a filing of 100 and you only get 5, that would be a 5% to actually get that change in the support.
Mr. Campbell, would that be something you understand what he's getting at, a little more background to the information we'd get, but so we kind of look at how many are asking for it and what percentage of those get it, and is that clear to you?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, the question is clear to me. It's not clear whether we can get the answer, because I think that the individual filing is with the courts themselves. And so if we can get that information from the court, then I think we will have a record of the modifications themselves.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney.
Having spent the last few years dealing with the courts, we may as well just forget getting that answer.
Mr. Campbell,
but you should try anyhow.
If you could try to get us some information, but what I'm maybe hearing from you is there's really no collection point, and maybe there doesn't need to be, but a collection point of how many requests for modifications are made and then how many are granted. That'd be something that would basically be 87 different counties handling it differently or handling it separately. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, I don't know that we can't get the information. We're certainly going to try, but I don't think we have filing information on our system. Where I think we do have modification information on our system. If we do have it, we will certainly make every effort to get it. There were other aspects to Representative Mahoney's question, and the costs, the filing costs. Mm-hmm. The filing costs are high. That is burdensome. Unfortunately, to change, only the court can change a child support order. We can't administratively do what the what the court has done. So it has to go back to court, and I would be the first one to think that that probably could be done in a more cost-effective manner than it is now, because it is a burden for people to pay.
So, Mr. Campbell, to that part of Representative Mahoney's question, Representative Mahoney's question, at least his understanding was that it's expensive and hard to do. Would that be concurrent with your feedback, or do you hear that at all, or is it $320? Is that the filing fee, I assume, for changing a child support order? But is there a process that might be easier or quicker for the parties to use that you've talked about or heard about, or is that not a problem? And I think you kind of indicated it maybe is.
Mr. Chair, I think it is a problem right now. We do have a project underway in our division called the Order Modification Grant that we're trying to simplify and automate to a considerable extent the process used to modify a support order, and it should simplify it, but it is a very complex process. I think if you stacked up all the papers that are required now to file a modification, it'd probably be about a third of an inch thick or something, and so it's fairly cumbersome. It's a process that probably very few people could do on their own, so they're going to need an attorney, and our hope is that we can simplify that to as much as possible, still allowing proper legal safeguards and stuff.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Campbell, on that issue, is that something you might see coming forward yet this session? Sounds like a potential piece of legislation in the making if a member is interested in this. Or how far along are you in this process? And mix into this question, do the child support magistrates, I believe we have a level of quasi-judges that kind of hear a lot of those cases, is that who they appeal to or file to, or are they handling something completely separate?
Mr. Chair, to file a modification, you would have to file it with a child support magistrate through the court process. Mm-hmm. We're not anticipating developing legislation to do what I'm talking about in terms of the order modification process. We're expecting to operate within the existing legal rules, but to simplify the process as much as possible to eliminate, to allow one, ideally, that to make it much more simple for a county to do it, and hopefully even a parent to do it on his or her own behalf. But the process is complicated in part because the fact that in 2005 we did guidelines, which basically requires the incomes from both the mom and the dad to be considered. So sometimes people don't have all that information by themselves, and it may or may not be difficult to get the information that you don't have, depending on relationship you have with the other parent.
Okay. And if you want to proceed ahead into that stuff, that information, that'd be good. One more question, and then I'll let you get back to that. Those other topics you were going to cover. Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Campbell, you talked earlier, and certainly you and others in your department are aware of where we're at in terms of the budgetary outlook of the state. You mentioned that federal money had decreased by $24 million, and I assume that's an annual figure, but curious as to whether that federal contribution, whether that was the first time that type of decrease had been imposed upon the state of Minnesota, or maybe there were more previous to that as well. And then I would be curious as to what exactly the department has done in order to mitigate that deficit. Have you reduced staff, cut expenses otherwise, or has the burden simply been shifted to the state?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Druskowski, these incentive payments have always been, the state gets them, we pass 100% on to the counties. So the counties are the ones that are suffering from the loss of the $24 million. Not, I mean, we as a state program obviously are affected by it. This originally occurred as a result of the Deficit Reduction Act that was of 2005, and it went into effect. The state legislature here passed, I think it was in 2007, a temporary remedy where we appropriated, I think, $7 million to help offset that shortage. The federal government themselves came in one year and reinstated the federal financial participation that we were able to get, but that expired last September 30th, and I don't know of any. I know that there's been a lot of effort to try to get it reinstated, but to my understanding, it's out. We haven't been able to cover it to make up that difference for the counties because we are suffering a severe budget issue ourselves.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Campbell, have you, I mean, given that reality, and certainly the counties are partners in the delivery of this program, has there been, I mean, certainly there was a wake-up call that went out with that. Have there been efforts to look at how do we redesign the program to mitigate that $24 million, or are we just passing the mandate, another unfunded mandate, from the federal government to the state and then back down to the counties?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, a number of years ago, we commissioned two studies. Both of them ended up going to Deloitte Corporation to look at our program and our automated system to see if our policies were as simple as they could be, as streamlined as they could be, and whether we could get efficiencies. That was one study. The other study looked at how services are delivered in Minnesota. And Deloitte made over 100 recommendations concerning the simplicity and efficiency of the program. And it made three recommendations concerning service delivery changes. Their first recommendation was that the state take over the program. The second recommendation was the state take over, or the counties continue to administer the program in a regional environment. And the third recommendation is that the program remain the same, but the state be given more governance and control over certain program aspects. We currently are working with a group, a committee that's composed of DHS, county social service directors, the courts, and county attorneys to see if there is a way that we could agree to changes that would, at least from the state's perspective, provide more governance to the program but allow it to essentially operate within the existing state-county relationship.
That answer your question? All right, Mr. Campbell, go. Oh, is there another question? Representative Runbeck.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Campbell. Going back to the cost of the program, maybe would you, when you're putting together information, give us some idea? I presume you are paying the cost to represent the custodial parent that the department is that right?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, we try to take as neutral a position in this program as we can. Currently, custodial parents are charged three different fees, an application fee if they're the one who apply, plus a 1% fee on amounts collected if they're not on public assistance, or if they were on public assistance, have been off for 2 years. And there's a federal $25 fee that's charged on amounts that we collect for a person over $500. And that's an annual fee. So there is a requirement for people getting support to help defray the costs.
Well, if you would, Mr. Chair and Mr. Campbell, if you would provide us, I would appreciate information in your cost breakout. What is the cost to you of representing the custodial parent in this process?
Mr. Campbell, is that some information you can get the committee and understand? We're a policy committee, but I think it does drive at there might be policies that also cost the department money or could be changed that would save money. Is that fair to say?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, and just thinking about the possibility, and I don't know where this stands, of course, but I mean, is there any role for an administrative, more of an administrative process in this area?
Mm-hmm. Good question, Mr. Campbell, if that would work to get us some information. Representative Druskowski has one more, and then I'd like you to get back to proceeding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, my own assessment is that there is a lot of room for more administrative work, and we've tried over the years to do things more administratively with the intention of holding down costs. In terms of trying to cost out exactly what is that portion of the money that is attributable to a servicing a custodial parent versus that portion of the money that's for servicing a non-custodial parent, I'm not quite sure how to divide those costs up.
Representative
Mr. Chair and Mr. Campbell. Well, okay, so I'm thinking, do you pay any of the cost then for the non-custodial parent? Are you basically assuming the cost for the whole process? Is that what
Campbell.
I'm hearing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, now and then the court can order that non-custodial parents can be assessed fees in certain circumstances to reimburse like the legal costs. By and large, I mean, I have to look. I don't know if where we charge a non-custodial parent directly for a service, like a fee, for example. Part of that is because of the way the federal regulations are set up. If we charge like that 1% fee, we actually charge to the person who applies for services. That can mm-hmm. be that could be either parent. In most cases, it's the person with the children.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Campbell, then we will be seeing, I presume, at some point in this process, some budget information, and we'll be able to take a look at the size of the program and where some of these costs occur.
Mr. Campbell, is there some information you could get Representative Runbeck and their committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, it would probably be helpful if we had if the committee could send us exactly what it is that they want. We will do everything in our power to provide it. But there's a whole slew of information. Here's a report that we put out, give you an idea of all the statistics that we have. That we put out, it's a Minnesota performance report. It has more in it than just cost information, but it has lots of information, and it'd be really helpful if you could focus on the specific information that you want, and we'll do everything in our power to get it to you.
Mr. Representative Runbeck, that'd be great.
Would that
Thank
work?
You, Mr. Could, Campbell, sure.
Could you, Mr. Reynolds, maybe get that information from you, or you send it to him, and he could pass it on to Mr. Campbell?
Yes, we'll do.
Okay. And Representative Hillstrom, I think, to this topic or issue question?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just want to make some clarification. You're an administrative agency that assists both sides. It's not like you go to court and make any representation of one side or the other. Is that correct? You're not... can you just...
Mr. Campbell?
I'm trying to get a clarification of what representation you actually give to either party.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we try to be neutral on our representation.
So maybe so in one of those handouts, Hillstrom. Does it specifically have what your role is and what you do for both sides? If I could just maybe get a handout or something on that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we'd be happy to provide you with a write-up as to what our role is in the child support program.
Okay. Sounds good, Mr. Campbell, and we can get that information as well. If you want to proceed.
Okay.
You know, Representative Druskowski had one question, so I'm sorry to have overlooked him.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Campbell, you know, I've had discussions in the past, and I understand that there aren't any eligibility requirements for the 4D program, and that has been largely because the interpretation of federal law that has come from many or maybe all of the state child support agencies has been that that is prohibited by federal law to require eligibility requirements. I know that there is some people that believe that the original intent of federal law was for, because of the way that 4D actually evolved, was supposed to be for strictly needy families or those families who were on child welfare services. And if indeed a state did, maybe Minnesota did, institute some eligibility guidelines, because right now, as I understand it, whether either or both parents have annual incomes of zero or $200,000 a year, in both of those cases and any and all between and above those amounts, they can apply for your services and you know, certainly cost the state taxpayers money and contribute to the deficit the way that we are seeing. Indeed, if we were to bring forward eligibility requirements, would this help us reduce the cost of the program, maybe address certainly that $24 million question, and help us contribute to our deficit issue we have here in state government?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gaskowski.
Mr. Campbell.
It's my understanding that it is prohibited to have an eligibility requirement for people. So I have a strong disagreement with those of you that are saying that this is something that we might be able to do. I think it's directly prohibited by federal law. I think we would incur extreme, drastic sanctions were we to do it. I don't know that it would provide all the money that one thinks that one could get from it, because to do something like that, one would have to have an eligibility system. Maxis, in the, you know, for the MFIP program, is an eligibility system that costs, you know, as much or more than our system does. So there's, one would have to pay money and shell out money to make money in this case. In our caseload, 65% of the cases that the custodial parent either is on or was on public assistance at one time. These are not rich people. By and large, there are people who do make $200,000 a year or whatever. I mean, that's true, but they are not the lion's share of our people. People paying, let's say, who are ordered to pay $1,000 or more in child support, are approximately 2 to 3% of the caseload.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. If you can finish the presentation, and probably down to about 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to skip over 2003.
Okay.
I'll skip over 2004 as well and go right to 2005, because 2005 represents the year when we changed the guidelines in Minnesota from one in which we looked at the non-custodial parent or obligor's income only, and then we made a determination to a new income shares model where we look at both the mother's income and the father's income to calculate an amount of child support. In that year, instead of looking at net income as we did under the previous model, we looked at gross income of the parties. We also took into consideration other obligations that either the mom or the dad had, such as other children in the home from different marriages or other child support obligations and stuff like that. plus there was a parenting time adjustment built into it, where if the parent without the child was seeing the child, let's say from anywhere from 10 to 45% of the time, they would get a discount on their child support to help address the costs that they had while they were with the child. We also at that time implemented a guidelines calculator that is out. It's on our DHS website. Anyone in this room can go to it, and if you have accurate information about both your income and the other parent's income, then you should, plus any of the other details that are required, you should be able to approximate what your child support obligation should be. In 2006, there was a recodification of child support, which basically took the child support out of 518 and put that language in its own chapter 518A. There were also further clarifications made to the guideline statute. The guidelines, although passed in 2005, didn't take effect until January of 2007. So there were quite a few clarifications that we went through in the course of that. One of the clarifications was taking a look at the grid that was actually developed. We hired a company called PSI Policy Studies, Inc., who's kind of like the national leader in looking at child support guidelines. We had them come in and analyze the guidelines that we had to see if they were appropriate or not. They found several areas where they were out of whack, and so the legislature accommodated that and made it put it within the bounds, so to speak. In 2005, that's when the Deficit Reduction Act was passed by the feds, and they required a $25 fee. In Minnesota, we charged that fee to the custodial parent, and it's charged on someone who's never received public assistance, and it's charged after $500 have been received. In 2007.
Mr. Campbell, just back on 2005, to clarify, prior to that legislation, the income was only counted from the non, and I understand we're using the wrong term here, but the parent without custody of the children? Is that the main change in 05? Or a big change, not maybe the main, but a big one?
Mr. Chair, I think that probably was the main change, going from looking at one person's net income to two people's gross income and putting it together, determining what share of that total income should be devoted to the child, and then looking at what each person's proportional share of that amount should be. And we also used that, I think that's probably the main thing, but there were really lots of other changes too. I think the parenting time adjustment is a big feature. Looking at other obligations that the parent have, such as other children in the home, these were always aggravations before this time, and now that they were addressed. There was also a self-support reserve built into it, so at the end of the calculation, we can look to see what has been ordered, and if that does not leave the parent paying support enough revenue, then we reduce other obligations, either medical support, child support, or child care support, and lastly, the basic support, or the money, if as needed to get the person at least up at that threshold for that self-support reserve, which I think is 120% of poverty, but I'm not positive.
So in a nutshell, have you in the department or division witnessed less confrontation, more satisfaction, less satisfaction? Any result you could give us as a committee on those changes? Did it neutralize some things? Did it make things worse? Is it not, or don't you have an opinion or enough information to to know whether it helped or hurt?
Mr. Chair, I think probably the safest answer for me and the true answer is I really don't have enough information. You don't hear very much about it. But I think that if you hear from a particular individual, if they were paying support and their support went up, it was a bad thing. If they were getting support and their support went down, it was a bad thing. And I don't know. I think it's there hasn't been a groundswell of information, either pro or against, coming to our office that I'm aware of.
Okay. Go ahead.
I guess what I'll just say more, most recently, I think the main thrust in the child support program has been simplifying it and trying to come up with a more cost-effective way of running it. I know in the last legislative session in 2010, we enacted an administrative redirection of support where support is ordered, but because the child is now in foster care or is on MFIP with a parent or stuff, we can administratively redirect that support to a different caretaker without having to go through court, and that saves counties a lot of time and money. We extended the statute of limitations on child support judgments from 10 to 20 years. These judgments, I think that was something that may make sense in some instances for certain types of debts. For the child support debts, we bill people, we're in contact with people so they know they owe the money. And so it was just an administrative requirement that costs money to do. And I don't know ever of hearing a case where we were denied an extension. So essentially we go now 20 years without having to do it every 10 years. And there was an expanded ability to request cell phone and email addresses from locate sources, as well as the expanded ability to get information from internet providers. We've had the ability to get locate information on people for a long, long time, but as technology has increased and we've gone from landline telephones to internet and cell phones and stuff, that was just a method to kind of get caught up to date. So there are some other things that I left off, but I think that's pretty much the major things that have happened in the program.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Any last questions, members? Representative Scott.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Campbell, I'm just curious how much, excuse me, how much unpaid child support is out there? Do you annualize that, or do you have one figure from so many years back? Or,
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it's over $1.6 billion.
Okay, and how far back do you go to get that number? Because that's certainly not an annual number.
Representative Scott, that's right. That goes back. That's how much there is from
20 years.
From the dawn of time, so to speak.
Okay. And do you ever write that off as bad debt, just like banks do?
Representative Scott, we do and we don't. We report a write-off to the revenue, but it really never comes off the system. We do work as part, I think I mentioned earlier that we work with parents trying to make sure that they're paying the right amount of support and stuff. We have a policy in place called SHLIF. It's an acronym that means Strategies to Help Low-Income Families. In part of that strategy, if we find that someone has a child support debt out there, an arrearage, and that accrued, whether it was not ability to pay, it could have been they were incarcerated, it could have been they were out of a job, they were sick, all those things, then we, you know, encourage counties to forgive that amount. So we are actively involved in reducing support, but that's not the same as like a write-off like private business does.
Right, I understand that point.
Scott.
Yes, and thank you, Mr. Chair. And so my question, I guess, would be if we just went from 10
a 10-year statute of limitations to 20, then wouldn't it make sense that after 20 years that that would drop off of your total number?
Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I think it depends. Our program stays active a lot longer than a lot of other programs. For instance, a child, if a child support order is established soon after the birth of a child, that child will not be emancipated potentially, you know, for 18 years. And so we have an ongoing child support case. A lot of it has to do with what caused the arrearages to accrue. Like I said, if there was a willful neglect to pay and there was the ability to pay, we would not be so inclined to write that money off. If there were periods of unemployment, if there were periods of incarceration where there was no ability to pay or a drastic reduction in the ability to pay, then there would be much more, I think, willingness on our part to try to make an equitable adjustment.
Thank you.
Scott, okay. Mr. Campbell, thank you for your presentation and overview, and if you can get that information to the committee that we talked about, you can be in contact with RCA. I think he's taken some notes as well, and he'll also follow up with information from Representative Runbuck and more specifics on her request. So thank you for coming to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, you know, there were things that were talked about that get your thoughts provoked or get you thinking about a piece of legislation, again, just let's do it sooner than later if you think there's things that should come before the committee. We're going to have Representative Lynn Aves from House Research give us just another 5 or 10 minutes on some recent family law matters that have been discussed in the legislature but not yet acted on. And just a quick note to the audience. Once she's done, we've got a couple of people that have been listed for a comment to the committee, but we'll have open microphone if others are interested. For 3 to 5 minutes, just give us some perspective of changes, whether it's business regulations and how we could improve the job environment, job creation environment in Minnesota, or other consumer or citizen issues that might be some statutory or regulatory changes. We're opening the microphone up to you in the audience. If you're here for that, feel free to pass your name up through a page to us, and we'll accommodate as time allows. So, Lynn, do you want to just give us a little background? And I understand Matt might join in a little bit of it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if it's all right, I think I might start.
Okay, Matt will start, and Lynn will clean up Matt.
That's right. Mr. Chair and members, we put together a document that basically walks through some of the other family law issues that have been referred to the Civil Law Committee in the past. I'm going to walk through that in just a minute. But first, just for the sort of committee members' background on how Lynn and I are dividing up the committee work this session. Lynn basically is going to be handling most of the family law stuff with one exception, and then I'll be here to help out with the other bills and other issues that come before the committee. Basically, the reason we do that is in House Research, we sort of assign subject areas rather than committees, and so Lynn handles family law, and I handle civil law and elections and other stuff as well. So that's why you'll see two of us, but at least one of us will be here during each committee hearing to help out as needed. And if you have questions or need assistance with bill drafting or amendment drafting or anything like that, feel free to let us know. And if we're not the right person, we can direct you in the right way. So there's a hand on your packet entitled Civil Law Issues Related to Families, which is the document that Lynn and I put together. Basically, like I said, this is a document that kind of walks through other family law issues that have been referred to the committee in the past. Like I said, Lynn kind of handles family law with one exception, and the exception is probate and estate issues, which is the first one on the list, and that's within my jurisdiction. Mr. Lake briefly mentioned the probate section of the bar in his presentation. This is one of the bigger areas of law for attorneys. Probate basically covers a number of end-of-life issues from a legal perspective, so like wills and trusts and succession of property and figuring out how to settle a person's estate after they die. Most of this law is contained in the Uniform Probate Code, which has been enacted in partial form in Minnesota and is sort of the basic framework for dealing with these issues both in Minnesota and in a number of states. You likely will see some type of legislation referred to the committee dealing with the Uniform Probate Code in one way or another. In the past, typically, these bills have been introduced to address specific issues of concern to members rather than wholesale changes to the Uniform Probate Code, but on occasion there have been some bigger issues that have come before the committee. Powers of attorney is an issue that isn't specifically within the Uniform Probate Code as enacted in Minnesota, but it is an issue that would come before this committee if there is legislation on that topic. A couple of years ago, there was a bill that was enacted related to powers of attorney for members of the military, and that came through this committee. One big issue related to probate that is sort of a frequent topic, if not in legislation, at least among sort of constituent requests and constituent questions that you all might be interested to know about as members of the Civil Law Committee, have to do with guardianships and conservatorships. Guardians and conservators are individuals that are appointed by the court to administer the affairs of a person who has a disability or who is incapacitated in some way. Guardians handle sort of personal well-being issues of individuals, and conservators handle financial and property issues for incapacitated individuals. Like I said, this is something that is a sort of frequent constituent question, so you might want to be prepared to handle those. In the recent past, there have been two bills that have been enacted related to guardianships and conservatorships. One is in 2007. There was a bill that mandated the state court administrator to issue a report to the legislature, sort of doing a wholesale look at the system of guardianships and conservatorships in Minnesota and to recommend changes to the process. In response to sort of a number of concerns related to the way the system works currently. That report was issued and came before the legislature last session, and there was a presentation to the Civil Justice Committee at the time about that report. And then in 2009, there was a somewhat more substantive bill that was enacted related to guardianships and conservatorships. This was a bill that was authored by Representative Thiessen that established a bill of rights for individuals who are subject to guardianship or conservatorship, created conflict of interest standards for guardians and conservators, and a new requirement that guardians must now register with the state court administrator. This is a process that is mandated to begin starting in 2013. There was also an authorization for a new fee to be collected from guardians and conservators related to that registration, which will begin in 2012. So as I said, based on sort of recent history, this is not an issue that comes with, guardianships aren't necessarily the highest volume in terms of bills coming before the committee, but it is sort of a frequent topic that you may hear about as the session moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the remainder of the family law issues, I went back for two biennia and looked at the total number of cases that have been referred to the Civil Law Committees and the number that were family law. And to put it in perspective, there were about 700 cases referred to the Civil Law Committees over those 4 years, and about 50 of those cases were family law cases. So it's not going to be a real high percentage of the bills that you hear or that are referred to the committee. The most frequent types of bills that were referred were those related to marriage, to custody and parenting time, and to child support. The most frequent constituent concerns typically are related to the custody parenting time issue and the child support issues. There are a range of concerns addressed by these bills. In the custody parenting time, it can go for anything from imposing penalties for interference with parenting time, abolition of custody presumptions. There's a real wide range. There are a lot of issues out there, as you heard Mr. Campbell discussing. There are a lot of concerns surrounding federal requirements that are placed upon states and what the state of Minnesota feels they can and cannot do based on the federal law. Federal law does require states to have certain things in place, say, regarding driver's license suspensions. The federal law does not state how a state has to suspend licenses. You just have to have a law in place. So a lot of the things related to child support, the child support penalties for arrears, are issues that constituents are very concerned about. I'm sure you probably are too, but I mean, I hear a lot of constituent concerns when I get phone calls. The marriage.
Ms. Aves?
Mr.
Chair. On that issue, maybe I'm the only one with this question, but you kind of delineated that the federal government requires that you have to have a suspension in place, but not how you suspend. Can you expand that a little bit more? And is that what gives us? I know there's been some issues about taking away the driver's license right away, and all of a sudden, parent in arrears is not able to get to work, and it just exacerbates the problem. Is that what gives latitude and creativity and flexibility in how the states do that, or can you expand a little more on that?
Mr. Chair and members, the federal law is prescriptive, but it only states, it gives a list of the penalties that states have to have in place for child support arrears and many, many other things. It says a process has to be in place for suspending a driver's license for a person that is in arrears. It doesn't state what that process has to be. That is up to the discretion of the state. In Minnesota, there is a fairly lengthy process that takes place before an obligor's license is suspended. It's not just being in arrears. There's a long process. But it's my understanding the state, it's up to each state to determine their process for suspending driver's licenses.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holbrook.
Thank you. Just for clarification purposes, it's my understanding that our process, if somebody pays something once every 3 months, they can avoid their license being suspended and they can continue to be in arrears for years if they make some type of minimal payment every 3 months. Is that accurate?
Ms. Aves.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I have heard that same concern expressed. It's my understanding that before a sanction can be imposed, a payment agreement has to be offered to the obligor, and that they have to comply with that payment agreement. It doesn't say that they have to continue to comply with it. It says they have to comply with it. And it's my understanding that if they comply for 2 months, that they can get their license back or that they've satisfied what the statute says.
And then, if I might, then the whole process starts over again, correct?
That would be correct.
Yeah.
So it's those types of issues that are going to cause you all headaches. And those are the hot topics. Marriage, in the past biennia, there have been 10 bills that have been introduced related to recognition of marriages performed in other states, the marriage being defined as between one man and one woman. There's been one technical bill that has been referred that was enacted in 2009. That was a technical bill brought by the clerks of the district courts about filing of marriage certificates and marriage solemnizations. Assisted reproduction has had 3 bills. That's been mainly regulating gestational carrier agreements, access to adoption, to birth records by adopted persons. I don't think we had anything last year referred, but there were some bills that were introduced earlier. But again, it's the child support collection, custody, and parenting time that seem to be the really hot topics. You'll hear some department bills related to child protection and human services policy and some of their licensing bills because they have issues related to data practices in them. But for the most part, that is just a real brief rundown about the family law types of bills that have been referred to the committee.
All right. Any last questions? All right, members, I hope that was a little insightful, a little jogged the memory, and a little maybe it piqued an interest or another question that you'll have to work on legislatively. The last part of our agenda is I wanted to just express an openness to the citizens of Minnesota and those interested in just offering comments to our committee, whether it be how do we improve the job creation environment in our state or something else to improve due process or other issues that might be out there. And so members of the audience, if you have an interest, now is your opportunity. Don't say we haven't asked you for some input. We would like your input, and this may not be the only opportunity we have, but early on the committee we always have less bills to deal with than once they all get introduced. So we have Mike Hickey and Bob Johnson that have asked to be on the list and are on the list. And if there's others, do get your name up here or feel free to come forward when they're done. Mr. Hickey, do you want to start?
Hi, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with National Federation of Independent Business. Actually, Bob Johnson's going to start, and I'm going to kind of bat cleanup.
Okay. Mr. Johnson, if you can introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'm here testifying today, Mr. Chairman, as a board member of an organization that the committee members will be getting a list momentarily here from the pages, on behalf of an organization called Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. And under your agenda, Mr. Chairman, this is a new legal entity that we formed in Minnesota. And as you'll see by the roster, it represents in excess of 25,000 Minnesota employers. And it's an A to Z of the economy, of trade associations, of individual businesses. And we're here on the agenda item of, again, of job creators and making specific suggestions for statutory changes to help economic development and grow jobs. And the issue that we're specifically here on, Mr. Chairman, is tort reform, changes to the civil justice system. I know we'll have other opportunities, but at least just to flag for the committee members that we believe that the legal system in Minnesota burdens businesses in this economy with unnecessary costs, and it has a negative impact on all of us, but on the economy, and that there's lawsuit abuse that needs to be addressed in this state. Is there evidence of that? And what we'll hand out to you, we don't have time today, Mr. Chairman, and we didn't follow your admonition about, but we will follow up and submit all this electronically to the committee so everybody will have copies of this. But there is direct concrete evidence of the link between tort reform, changes to the civil justice system in a state, and jobs and economic development. And the three items that I'll cite, and then I'm going to mention one specific reform, and then Mr. Hickey will finish. But the three items that one of which you'll have a copy of here momentarily is a study by, it's a group called the Perryman Group. It's an economic analysis and research firm in Waco, Texas, that's been operating countrywide, but in that state for 25 years, to examine the impact of tort reforms in the state of Texas over the last 10 years. And the conclusions in that report, I'll just cite a couple, Mr. Chairman, for time purposes, and urge the committee to look at this document. Because here's one state with the specific reforms analyzed that concludes the total impact of tort reform since 1995 in the state of Texas has been gains in spending of $112 billion in that state and employment gains in Texas of 499,000 jobs. And then there's more detailed breakdowns in that report. The fiscal stimulus to the state from these reforms is about $2.5 billion per year. I know these are staggeringly big numbers, but this document that you're getting, and when we submit the electronic, there are some very detailed appendices that reflect the work of the academics that support those conclusions. But that's one document that shows the track record in one state with the analysis of the numbers and the basis of the numbers to demonstrate the link between tort reforms in a state and jobs and economic development and growth in the economy, an increase in state revenue. The second document that I'll mention, I don't have copies of, Mr. Chairman, it's a document in a new study that's come out by the Pacific Research Institute. Pacific Research Institute for 30 plus years has been doing studies And one of the studies that they've just come out with is called the U.S. Tort Liability Index, a 2010 report. It's a very rigorous statistical analysis of the 50 states. And it looks at, they call them tort inputs and tort outputs. Tort inputs are what's your state law, and there's about 22 very specific types of laws that are evaluated. And then the statistical analysis looks at what's the output under those two states. And so what this report does, it assesses the opportunities for change, the consequence of inaction, the benefits of tort reform. And Minnesota's in the report, and we can't, with the time here, get into the details, but I would urge the committee to look at this document and look at how Minnesota stands vis-a-vis the other 49 states. And again, it's very concrete statistical analysis of what happens if state laws changed in specific areas in terms of what kind of economic growth, change, impact, revenue impact the state could expect as a result of those changes. That's the second point, Mr. Chairman, that goes specifically to the point of the linkage between tort reform and jobs and economic development. The last one, Mr. Chairman, is just from our neighbor to the east, just kind of a current update. That when Governor Walker was sworn in Wisconsin just a couple of days ago, within 2 hours of his swearing in, he's calling a special session of the Wisconsin legislature to enact civil justice reforms for the purpose of creating jobs in the state of Wisconsin. So at least our neighbor, immediate neighbor to the east, again, additional evidence on a current basis of a link between those two documents. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just end with mentioning one specific reform. We don't have language here today. We're working on it. We'll have this completed soon, and you will all be seeing that. But I'd like to mention just we will have a bill that we'll call it Class Action Reforms, and I'll just briefly mention, Mr. Chairman, what's in it. But the Class Action Reform Bill will, one, have in it a provision providing for, it's called Interlocutory Appeal of Class Action Certification. So the shortened version of that is that once a judge certifies a class, if the defendant wants to challenge the certification, that challenge proceeds, but the lawsuit also proceeds. In other words, so costs are being incurred in the system while a corporation, if it's a corporation sued, discovery and other those related costs. We believe that Minnesota should join the group of states that have passed a law that specifically provides for interlocutory appeal of class action certifications, which would then stay discovery and other actions while the challenge to the certification is taking place. We think it's prudent to let's find out if it's a legitimate class action before costs are incurred in the system. So that'll be one part of the class action bill. The other two parts, very brief summary of those, is that the bill will have a damage requirement. In other words, we believe it should be in state law that in order for a plaintiff to join a class, a plaintiff should have suffered some sort of damage. That's not the case today. The third part of that bill will be a causal link requirement that a plaintiff to sue a defendant should be required to show that there was a causal link between whatever action the defendant did and the plaintiff's damages. And we believe in Minnesota law that is not the case. That is not a clear point. So that'll be one bill. Those will be the three features of the class action reform. With that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hickey has.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Lesh has a question, then Representative Simons, if we can interject them.
Thank you.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, thank you for this very pretty handout. It's full color too, which I always appreciate it when I get full color because it makes it more fun to read. But my question is for you. I noticed, first of all, on page 17, it highlights again malpractice being an area. I mean, both sides of the aisle here have heard repeated statistics that in Minnesota, that is not a cause, or less than 2% of a cause for increasing medical costs. So, you know, maybe it is in Texas, but apparently we don't have that problem here. So I'm wondering if you're maybe trying to apply an incorrect standard. But primarily my question for you is, Mr. Johnson, if it's not the courts, and if we want to restrict people's ability to bring grievances through the courts in the interests of more jobs, what do you think is the best forum to resolve disputes if I have a dispute with someone, maybe a business, for anyone, other than, you know, high noon with a six gun on my hip? What's the best forum?
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Johnson,
we're not here to propose the abolition of the civil justice system. I've laid out one specific reform dealing with one specific aspect, class actions. I think, as you'll see, the agenda of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, Mr. Hickey, he and I are both board members, that you'll see that we have a targeted agenda that deals with, as I indicated up front, there's a lawsuit abuse. And so we're focused in on what we believe to be items where there's loss of abuse, where there is either meritless litigation, and we're drilling in on those specific items. The Texas report is brought to the table not to, you know, this is an analysis of what Texas did. The bills that we're going to be introducing aren't what Texas did. Texas did a whole lot, but this isn't the place here to go through that. This is to demonstrate that there is current economic evidence available that directly links a state's passage of tort reforms with growth of jobs and revenue in that state economy. That's why we brought the Perryman Group report here to you today. That's a question that's come up in the debate regularly. Is there any link between a bill that you might pass into law here and the jobs and the revenue in the state's economy? And we're here to testify today to say, yes, there is. Here's two documents that specifically go to that point. So I'm not here to endorse all of the reforms in Texas, because we're doing that round, or at least lay out for you a brief outline of what we're proposing. So we're not proposing an abolition of the civil justice system, I guess, if that's what you're asking. We're proposing changes to the current system.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Lesh.
I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't clear in my question, Mr. Johnson. No, I don't believe you're here to abolish the civil justice system, but the changes would commensurately restrict or reduce the number of lawsuits. I'm presuming that's where the savings would come from. Therefore, if there are disputes out there that are not resolved through the civil justice system, by abrogation of the bringing of lawsuits, there must be another forum. Now, if I'm in your shoes, I'm probably going to answer, well, it's through contracts and mandatory arbitration clauses and these other things, but I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm asking you what you think is the best alternative for those.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Lesh, at least on the point I'm talking about right now, class action, we believe that other states have done this. This is the things we're proposing are not unique here. A number of states provide in state law interlocutory appeal, class action certification. So this is not a hybrid, and its intention is to more intelligently manage the class action so that resources aren't expended, because if it's ultimately adjudicated that it's not a proper class, then we've just, frankly, wasted money in the system for an inappropriate class action. So, again, for me, I think that's the response to the question. And frankly, if there are cases that shouldn't be brought and our reforms are intended to take them out, there isn't an alternative remedy. It's been properly handled and it shouldn't have been there in the first place. There are scores of class action examples. We don't have the time, but we'll follow up and supply the committee members with a litany involving Minnesotans with class actions where, A, the consumers either got no remedy, nothing, or a coupon or a discount or a 50-cent coupon or something. And we believe that there are serious questions about the appropriateness of class actions and that. So we're not looking for an alternative. We actually think it should be fixed. And perhaps those suits shouldn't even be there. So it's not a matter of enough. If you're asking me, should there be another forum where that goes, well, this is a proper form if an individual has been harmed by conduct and the harm is caused by the negligence of some corporation or entity, and they should be responsible for the results of that harm caused if there was negligence on their part. So we're not here to blow up tort law, if you will, basic tort law and function. We're saying there needs to be changes in tort law, and there's other items here that if we can get to them, you'll see it's adjustments the current system and how the ground rules operate under the Minnesota civil justice system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lester, then we got
to. I know, I understand that. And I didn't really get an answer to the question. I understand the
this
talking
This is just
points.
A thumbnail sketch, just so you know. We'll have more time
Absolutely,
to discuss
I appreciate this. That. But I'm looking forward to the fleshing it out a little bit more because the report, as I can see, doesn't really apply to Minnesota. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Simons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments, and I appreciate this discussion. I assume we'll have it on an ongoing basis. Let's be clear just about a few facts here. Civil litigation is down in the last decade by 40% in Minnesota. 40% fewer civil cases now than 10 years ago. It's actually more than 40%. So I think sometimes when we talk about tort reform, it's kind of one of those inkblot Rorschach tests. It's what everyone interprets it the way they want. Tort reform can mean one thing to one person. I don't know what Texas did, and I can't speak to their experience. I appreciate that we're hearing today about specific reforms, but just in case people think that, you know, ambulance chasers are running all over the state and clogging the courts with cases, that is just not the fact. And evidence is for everyone. I believe in evidence. We all do. And the evidence is that we have fewer lawsuits today, not more. The other thing is, and look, this is what I do for a living. I am in business litigation with a law firm in Minneapolis, and I suspect that's what Representative Wardlow does as well. He's also with a reputable firm in the metro area. And my observation is that some of the folks who tend to make up these coalitions, they're all for litigation when they're a party and they're a plaintiff, just not when individuals sue them. So when it comes to medical malpractice, when it comes to an individual employee that's suing them because of some grievance, that they don't like. But when insurance companies are plaintiffs, as they were recently against Toyota, for example, where a consortium of seven insurance companies sued Toyota, and by the way, Toyota, of course, claimed that the lawsuit was frivolous, and the insurance company said, no, it's not. When it's individuals, then they don't like it. But when their right to go to court to sue someone else for copyright infringement or trademark or even another insurance company or another business, when I'm looking on the list, and I don't want to pick on these folks, I'm sure they're very good people, but if Burnsville Bowl is suing Classic Bowl, which is two down from it on this list on the front page, that's okay. But if an employee of Burnsville Bowl says that they slipped and fell, then they're just an ambulance chasing leech. Now, you didn't say that. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I hope as this discussion goes forward, we really, really delineate what kind of litigation people don't like. Is it just litigation from individuals suing big entities, corporate or otherwise, or is it all litigation? And in my experience in here, this is, you know, my fourth term, what we're mostly talking about is the kind of litigation they don't like. But when they're plaintiffs, whether it's insurance companies or other large entities that I represent, by the way, often, I want to tell you, this is how I make my living. They're just fine. Best Buy is fine when they can sue in state and federal courts. Insurance companies are fine. Some of our greatest corporate citizens. It's only the litigation where individuals are suing them that they don't like on a class action basis or employees or someone who slipped and fell or whatever. And I hope we'll be able to flesh that out because I'm sensing already that there's that double standard.
Mr. Johnson, a brief response. Otherwise, Mr. Key will.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there was a question in there.
No,
I
think. Well, why don't we move to Mr. Hickey, and then there's a Tim Kinley in the audience that wants to talk as speak as well. And if there's others, raise your hand or send a note. Mr. Hickey.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest small business group and the largest business group in terms of entities, with about 13,000 members. That's an interesting stat, Representative Simon. I'm not aware of that, but our members still continue to be very concerned about liability, very concerned about lawsuits, and it fits in the equation any business owner's head. What am I facing? What do I have to worry about? How much money do I spend trying to play defense on this? And that's why we've been involved in this coalition for a long time, and you can ask almost any small business owner. I think you'll find some concern, ranging from some concern to a lot of concern about liability and the cost of it and what to worry about and how to protect against it. There's just a couple other issues that the coalition is pushing at the moment. It's kind of our opening agenda. Who knows what will come out of this committee process, maybe. Many more issues, and we look forward to working with you on all of them. Our second issue is reducing Minnesota's general statute of limitations from its current six to 2 or 3 years. The national average is about two. And I think a good reason to do this, one, is Minnesota's carved out all kinds of statute of limitations changes, most of them shorter, and a few instances longer, such as with home builders on a new home.
and a few things of that nature, but we feel 6 years is unworkable. Memories become fuzzy, evidence becomes destroyed, and it's just very hard to adjudicate disputes on a timeline like that, and so we're going to definitely push a bill and urge you to pass it to reduce it to 2 or 3 years. We think that'd be a step forward. That's still a very long time to decide if you're going to bring a claim, and I still believe the Department of Human Rights has a 1-year statute of limitations. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if you want their assistance, you have to decide within 365 days if you're going to go forward. And so, you know, that's one case where it's 1 year. For a lot of suits, it's still six, a very long, unworkable period of time, in our opinion. The other issue is the rejection of settlement offer legislation that Representative Thiessen authored, and it hits on the point you talked about, Representative Simon, about when an employee is suing a company. A lot of it deals with this bill deals with the fee-shifting statute and a lot of its employment law. And currently, a plaintiff could reject a settlement offer, take it to a full trial, get less, and really rack up some large fees and expenses and be awarded all that. And what this bill that Representative Thiessen authored, and we hope to keep him involved, says that if you reject a settlement offer, take the case to court and get less, you're only going to get fees up to the point of the offer. And we think it provides a real incentive for people to try to get these disputes resolved before they get into the court system and further clog them. But just one example that came out of government, this is not just a business issue. This is something that can affect your local city, your school district, your local county. Coming out of Ramsey County, they had a case where ultimately Ramsey County had to pay $330,000 in attorney's fees, and the award was $129,000. It kind of begs the question, at what point does the arms race of dollars spent should stop? How much money should you spend litigating over any job, but especially if the job is a lower wage job? At what point does it just not make sense to be spending double the amount, or in this case about double the amount in fees? And so we think that's a very fair bill. It's going to encourage settlements, and it rewards a business defendant who does make a very responsible settlement, and the court verdict bears that out because they got less. They got less than was offered to them. And so those are that rounds out our three bills to date. I'm sure a lot of other ideas are going to come forward. We look forward to working with you on it. Mr. Chairman, do you want me to touch on any of the state regulations and rules? I know you're quite concerned about that. Do you want to save that for another day? Or
You know, if we can do it, just touch on it in 60 seconds, then we need to get to one question and then one more.
Sure, yeah, and appreciate your concern. Regulations drive businesses crazy, and the smaller you are, sometimes the worse you're hit. You don't have that really bright person in the HR department or risk manager or somebody else to deal with as you're doing it yourself, and you're doing it at the end of the day after the employees have gone home usually. And so this broad delegation that's occurred at the state and federal level of delegating more and more power to the agencies, and then it comes back in a form of rules and regulations, is a real concern. And, Mr. Chairman, we appreciate your concern. Representative Seifert and Senator Senjum had a great idea back in 2003. If it costs more than $25,000 for a business to comply with, the legislature had to reapprove it. Brings it back to you, members of the legislature, to take a look at a rule that's considered expensive. Possibly we could ratchet that down to $10,000 or whatever amount people felt was the right amount, but it would bring a new rule that we knew had real expense back to you to approve it or not approve it. The governor currently has power to approve rules. Some people say the governor should know what's going on with the rulemaking, but he gets one more bite at the apple. If a rule takes effect, it goes to him, and he can veto a rule or nullify it before it occurs. There's other ideas people have, but you could try passing a law that would be modeled under the Federal Regulatory Fairness Act, but it's a very complicated law. It's tough to deal with, and at the federal level, they've created a new agency to be the watchdog on that and to create a state regulatory flexibility law. Without an advocacy agency riding herd on the law, I don't think would accomplish much. And possibly a commission or a working group to review a lot of rules, try to review as many as you can. That'd be another option. There's a lot of different ideas we could try. I did like Representative Seifert and Senator Senjum's idea to get it back before the legislature, because that really is a way to make things totally representative. Unfortunately, the governor at the time vetoed it. Governor Plenty. But I appreciate the time, and I'll be around on this issue and on the regulations issue, too, if you want to take a stab at that this year.
Maybe it was his youthful beginning of his 8 years as governor. But, Representative Grunhagen has a question, and then we're going to get to the next testifier. Thank you, Mr. Hickey, but Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick observations on the medical malpractice. I own an independent insurance agency, and I have some healthcare workers insured, or clients of mine. One of them happens to be a nurse that just graduated recently. She works at our local hospital. When I asked her about how her job was going just a few months ago, she said, well, it's going very well. I enjoy taking care of the patients, but the amount of paperwork that I have to do is just extensive and overburdening. And when I asked her why that amount of paperwork was or documentation was necessary, she said, to protect against the threat of lawsuits, okay? So I think there is an overburden of the threat of lawsuits on our medical industry to the fact where we have a nurse who's spending more time on documentation to protect against lawsuits than to take care of the patients. And if that's the situation, I think it does need reform, and I'd urge this committee to consider medical malpractice insurance reform. The other observation I just bring quickly, in my own district, I happen to attend a county commissioner's meeting, and it's very difficult for small communities in our state to have a full-time doctor. And when I ask one of the reasons why, it's because of the overhead cost. And one of the highest parts of the overhead cost is medical malpractice insurance reform. So having high medical malpractice insurance costs is actually keeping doctors from being able to locate in smaller communities, and to a certain degree endangering the health of the people in those communities. Finally, I just say this. Mr. Johnson quoted extensive studies. I'm a layperson, not a lawyer, okay? But I've done a certain, being in the insurance industry, especially health insurance, for over 30 years, I've tried to read and study extensive background on the threat of lawsuits on both health insurance premiums and the healthcare industry in general. And I do think there is some needed reforms. I do think Mr. Johnson brings forth a very valid point. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Real brief.
I'm sorry. I need to leave. We're past our adjournment time, but I do want to just have a quick update from you on the 21st, I believe. Is there what the expectation is for the committee and a law school program? And
Representative Holberg, good point. The William Mitchell and I've got the email. I haven't read it yet. There's law school for legislators, the annual event at William Mitchell. All legislators, I understand, were invited. I plan to send out an email update on that, but members might want to carve out the 21st of January in your schedule for attending that event. And I guess, Representative Holberg, I thought I would just send out an email to committee members. Is there more you're looking for?
No, right? I saw it kind of on the horizon, and we're not going to meet again until next Wednesday, so I was just curious.
Right. That'll come out this week or soon.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I could just briefly before you adjourn, this is Lesh, Mr. Chair.
Oh, there you are. Okay, Representative Lesh.
I wanted to thank you for your amenability to meeting with myself and offering to meet with the DFL members. I look forward to this being a productive session from the perspective of the DFL members, and as always, we shall be, as you characterize it, good minority members, Mr. Chair, which includes asking multiple questions, but I want to appreciate your offer of cooperation.
All right. Thank you, and Mr. Hickey and Mr. Johnson, I think we don't need any more from you. I do want to let Mr. Kinley speak. He's another person that we had asked to talk. So, Mr. Kinley, I know we're getting to the end, but I do want to give you a few minutes here.
I hope to be brief. Tim Kinley, please. I am involved with a number of family rights groups and judicial reform groups. And I know you don't deal with judicial reform this year, but I think it's a big issue that needs to be dealt with in the family law arena. I've heard a number of judges say I don't have to follow the law, and so I think that's a problem. But we'll address that there. My biggest heart is parenting time, and that hasn't been talked about. But I know a lot of the committee members here are dealing with that issue, so I'm going to push that aside and deal with the some of the issues that were brought up today regarding eligibility requirements. The county only helps custodial parents. They do not help non-custodial parents in regards to child support. So if you have a custodial father that's making $400,000, $500,000 a year, has $2 million in assets, the county will pay for his legal services if his ex-wife is making $20,000 a year. And the ex-wife will have no, she'll have to pony up her own money if she's not paying the child support. So I'm surprised that the director of the child support service doesn't know that. That's just baffling. It's bizarre, to say the least. So a couple, also a number of statements have been made about the federal law requires these things. It's my understanding that there is no state in compliance with the federal law, and every year they have to go in and ask for exemptions because they're not complying. And in that regards to the driver's license issue, I have not talked to anybody, and I'm sure there are many out there that think driver's license should be taken away, but I see that as a big cost to the state and the legal system and the police system. And the people I've talked to say, I don't understand that. It doesn't make sense to somebody who is financially struggling already to take away their license so that they can't get to work or travel, go to church, go to the grocery store, make it extremely difficult for them. And even custodial parents don't understand that. If you take away my ex-husband's or the non-custodial parent's ability to get to work or to use a vehicle for work, I have no chance of getting any child support. They go underground. They are underground, and you're not getting taxes on them. They're out of the system. So it's just something that just doesn't sit right and resonate with a lot of people. And then an odd thing with the cost of child support, what it costs to raise a child. We have a foster care system in Minnesota, and the foster care system uses numbers that says it costs this much to raise a child, X amount of dollars. Okay, but if you're a non-custodial parent, that cost is higher. Okay, and the reason that cost is higher is because the state gets 66% of every dollar that's put into the child support, that's run through the child support system, gets reimbursed from the federal government. So you have judges increasing the amount of what people earn. You have judges for full-time parents making $5,000 a month. They're saying, well, you can go out and get a second job. Even though it's against the law to do this, they'll do it anyway. So the child support payment is more than what they actually earn. And it's because, well, you got to go fight it now and go appeal it and spend all your time and money. And it's just a self-defeating system when the judges actually benefit from this money because it comes into the system and helps pay their income. There's somewhat of a conflict of interest there, just the way the system is designed. And, you know, I'll be around to all of you there, but I just wanted to raise some of these issues. You can go in and ask for exemptions. So for driver's license and for the eligibility requirements to get help from the county for collection of child support, you can get an exemption. And I would think if you presented a rational case that here's why we're not doing it, it's costing us a lot of money, and people that could afford to get legal help, you know, we're paying millionaires and people that are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, we're paying for the legal services, and that's just not right. And it's costing the state money, and we can be better using it in other ways. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kinley. Any burning questions, members? Otherwise, I believe Mr. Kinley will be around, and others. We're exhausted the time. Thank you for the first committee. Members, just a reminder, thank you, Mr. Kinley. And members, if you want to keep your stuff in your packet or stuff that you do want to keep, take it with you. The pages will collect the rest and recycle what's necessary. And I just want to take with you what you want if you do. So with that, this meeting is adjourned. And we'll let you know when the next one is.